Alexander von Humboldt, the forgotten father of environmentalism.
He was the forgotten father of environmentalism, so he warned of harmful human-induced climate change already in 1800. And because he comes up with this idea of nature as a web of life, which is very much the concept of nature that still shapes our thinking today, I feel that his ideas today are more relevant than ever before.
That's Andrea Wolf talking about her best-selling new book, The Invention of Nature. It's listed as one of the 10 best books of 2015 by the New York Times. Then we check in with journalist Jack Cushman of Inside Climate News about the historic climate pact out of Paris.
The negotiators managed to get pledges from 195 or so countries, 190 countries, each explaining what they feel they're able to do at this time, and that engaged the whole world. That is really historic, because there's no way to solve this problem if only some countries in the world deal with it aggressively.
That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. The great naturalist and explorer Alexander von Humboldt lived in a time when the Industrial Revolution was just beginning. The big idea then was that all life was some kind of machine with separate parts, a machine man had the right to dominate. That crazy notion still drives our globalized political economy. The understanding that our world is composed of an intricately connected web of life, we think that's a modern idea, but Humboldt realized it all the way back in the 18th century. His explorations in the Americas and elsewhere sparked brilliant insights into the balance of nature and how people were already threatening it. He inspired Charles Darwin, Henry David Thoreau, and John Muir, to mention just a few, and he understood before anyone else how human activity was causing climate change. You could even say Humboldt was the first environmentalist. He was also the most famous scientist of his time. Yet few of us in the English-speaking world have heard of him, even though more places on the globe are named after him than anyone else, like Humboldt County in California. But now, thanks to Andrea Wolf, we get to discover Humboldt again. She's written a fascinating biography, The Invention of Nature, Alexander von Humboldt's New World. It's on the New York Times list of 10 best books of 2015. It won the 2015 Kirkus Prize and is shortlisted for several prestigious awards to be announced next year. In addition to The Invention of Nature, Andrea Wolf is the author of several other acclaimed books, including The Brother Gardeners, which we talked to her about in 2009, and Founding Gardeners. The Invention of Nature, Alexander von Humboldt's New World. Andrea Wolf, it almost sounds like this title could be a double entendre.
So it refers to Humboldt's five-year exploration of Latin America, which was then regarded as the New World, but it also refers to that he comes up with a new concept of nature, a new world, basically, in which he sees nature as a web of life and describes Earth as a living organism.
And you call Alexander von Humboldt the forgotten founding father of environmentalism. He was much better known in his own time than today. Why did you feel it was important to tell people today about him?
Well, I think he is actually one of the most important scientists. It's a little bit as if Isaac Newton or Einstein had been forgotten. He was the forgotten father of environmentalism, so he warned of harmful human-induced climate change already in 1800. And because he comes up with this idea of nature as a web of life, which is very much the concept of nature that still shapes our thinking today, I feel that his ideas today are more relevant than ever before. And I feel that we should really know about him. It's almost like as if the environmental movement start their history with, say, Thoreau or even only John Muir, but actually we can go much further back. And I think learning about Humboldt really gives us a sense of where we are today and what we should do today, because he was The extraordinary thing about him was that he was incredibly interdisciplinary, and he has this idea that nature is a global force. So I think, you know, these ideas remain resoundingly topical today. He warned of the destruction of the forest. He warned about the effects of irrigation and of monoculture, all topics which are incredibly important today.
You start the book with Humboldt climbing what was then thought to be the highest mountain in the world, Chimborazo in Ecuador. Why was he there, and what epiphany did he experience on its heights?
So when he went on his exploration through Latin America, he tried to see as many different ecosystems as possible, although he doesn't call them ecosystems. And one of the parts of the journey was crossing the Andes all the way from what's today northern Colombia all the way down to Lima, 2,500 miles through, you know, some of the harshest landscapes on this planet. And what he did is, along the way, he climbed every reachable volcano. So by the time he reaches Chimborazo in June 1802, he's really the most experienced mountaineer in the world. And what happens is he climbs these mountains, and he realizes that climbing them is almost like a botanical journey from the equator to the pole. So he sees tropical species in the valleys, but he then also sees how the vegetation changes with altitude. And he realizes when he's on Chimborazo, and that's his kind of epiphany really there, is that as he's standing on the top of the world, his kind of vision of nature clarifies, and he realizes that there are vegetation zones in this world. Now, that doesn't sound very exciting to us, but then it's a time, and we have to remember that, where other scientists were looking at nature really through the very narrow lens of classification. So instead of seeing plants in terms of their taxonomic units, he looked at them as global vegetation zones. And he realized that a lot of the plants he was seeing in the Andes reminded him of plants he had seen elsewhere in the world, like in the Alps in Switzerland, for example. And he makes this incredible connection and says that these vegetation zones are actually across continents. So they're like wavy belts which go across the globe, which was a very, very new way of looking at nature at that time.
What do you think it was about him that allowed him to have this holistic vision?
One of the amazing things about Humboldt is, and that's something a lot of his contemporaries comment on, is that he had an unbelievable memory. So he could remember the shape of a leaf or, you know, the layering of rocks decades later. So he would, you know, for example, go later when he's 60, he goes to Russia on another exploration, and his mind then races back to things he had seen 40 years earlier in Europe or 30 years earlier in Latin America. And because he could then compare, he could see these kind of global links between different parts of nature. And I think that's one of the reasons. And the other is that he was incredibly curious. So he never stopped asking people. He always collected stuff. His guides in Latin America, for example, commented that his pockets were always stuffed with, you know, bits, rocks, insects, leaves, plant specimens, which he had collected everywhere. And they said, like a little boy, basically.
Mm-hmm. Now, he created a drawing to express his concept of the world.
Yes. The other thing about Humboldt is that he's very much the first scientist to use scientific data in a visual way, in a graphic way, which is, of course, something we do all the time now. But what he did is, after the climb of Chimborazo, he did a sketch of a cross-section of the mountain. And in this cross-section, he wrote onto the drawing, onto the sketch, he wrote all the plants he'd found according to their altitude. And then he had, to the left and to the right, he had columns where he, if you go from a certain altitude to the left columns, for example, you could see data on the, you know, gravity or the blueness of the sky or the humidity of the air. So you could see in one glance, basically, everything there was to learn about this mountain in one, on one page. And he also calls it his microcosm on a page.
As you said before, Alexander von Humboldt was the first scientist to talk about human-induced climate change in 1800, no less. How did he put this together?
When he went traveling through South America, he observed how colonists had basically destroyed the forest to make way for cash crops. And seeing this destruction, he saw, for example, how with the disappearance of the forest, the brushwood had also disappeared. And then heavy rains had washed off the good topsoils. And then he also saw that, for example, the water levels of a lake were falling because farmers had diverted the water to irrigate the fields. So seeing this destruction, he's really the very first to explain the fundamental function of the forest for the ecosystem and the climate. So he talked about the forest's ability to store water, the forest's ability to enrich the atmosphere with moisture, their protection against soil erosion. So he starts to talk what he calls mankind's mischief to unbalance nature. So he begins to understand how the destructive hand of man, basically, has an impact on the environment, which, you know, again, is something very, very innovative and new at that time, because this is a time when most people believed that God had created nature entirely for the use of mankind. This is a time when neat fields, for example, seem to be, you know, were regarded as the epitome of beauty, where untamed forests were seen as hostile environments. So here's a man who actually says, well, no, we can't just, you know, use nature as, you know, as much as we want. We have to also protect nature, because otherwise it will disappear. And he's in his really bleak moments, he talks about, which I find extraordinary, he talks about that in the future humankind might be able to go to other planets. And then he warns and says, if we do that, we will take our greed with us, and we will also destroy those planets and make them barren and ravage them as we have done with Earth.
That's a very profound statement to be saying back in those days. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Andrea Wolfe about her terrific biography about the great 18th/19th century explorer and naturalist Alexander von Humboldt, The Invention of Nature. It's interesting. I recently saw the film This Changes Everything, which is based on Naomi Klein's book of the same name.
Yes.
And they talk quite a bit about the paradigm that ran the Industrial Revolution, that runs modern extractive capitalism, this idea that we've been given dominion over nature, and the need to create an understanding that we are a part of nature. It's so extraordinary that he anticipated this, and he also had a great impact on others in his time. I wonder why his theories didn't end up prevailing in informing this worldview.
Well, the interesting thing is actually that in his time and a little later, up until the early 20th century, he is actually the founding father of everybody who is dealing in conservation and preservation. So, for example, he influences heavily Henry David Thoreau. So when Thoreau is writing Walden, he is struggling to write it, and then he basically puts away the manuscript, and then he reads Humboldt's book Cosmos, and he takes it out again and rewrites his manuscript. Or maybe even more important, Humboldt has an extraordinary influence on John Muir, who's now called the father of the national parks. And when we look at John Muir's Humboldt books, which amazingly still exist in an archive in California, we can see that they're heavily annotated, and it's like reading Muir having a conversation, really, with Humboldt. And Muir's ideas on forest preservation, his warnings about the destruction of nature, his ideas on watersheds, all that, he has underlined that in his Humboldt book. So, and Muir himself says as a young man, how intensely I want to be a Humboldt. So the influence is very strong, or on George Perkins Marsh, who wrote a book in 1864 called Man and Nature, which is really America's first environmental book, an incredibly important book, where George Perkins Marsh warns about the destruction of the environment. The problem is that that all then gets forgotten, basically with World War One. That's the moment when Humboldt kind of disappears in the English-speaking world because the anti-German sentiment becomes so strong.
So it was the war that wiped away this awareness. That's so interesting because it was also this war that industrialized warfare.
Yes, Humboldt is forgotten today in the English-speaking world. Amazingly, he's not in the in Latin America. Every school child, for example, has heard of Humboldt in Latin America. He's a bit like Jefferson here. And of course, in Germany, he's very well known. Although he's not really known so much as the father of environmentalism, that's very much an aspect of his work that has been forgotten today. And that's, I think, for me, the most important aspect, because he sees nature as a web of life. Almost like a tapestry of nature. He sees that if we pull one thread, we might unravel the whole. And I think a lot of environmentalists, ecologists, and nature writers today remain firmly rooted in his vision of nature, but you know, very few have actually heard of him. So I think it's just a good time now to remind ourselves where these beliefs are really coming from.
Also in this book, Andrea Wolf, The Invention of Nature, Alexander von Humboldt's New World, you write about how he met Goethe, and you talk about the whole way that imagination and reason, romanticism and science were brought together by him in these wonderful discussions he had with Goethe and other thinkers of that time.
Yes, Humboldt was a very close friend of Goethe, actually. They met when Humboldt was a young man in his mid-20s in Jena and Weimar, which was then very much the center of intellectual thought in Germany. And the relationship with Goethe is very interesting because it's a two-way relationship. They influence each other very much so. When Humboldt meets Goethe, Humboldt is very much a child of the environment. He believes in rational thought, in reason, in measuring the world. And Goethe, who is a poet but also a scientist, is the one who introduces Humboldt really to this idea that you should use your eyes, your imagination and your feelings to understand nature. And when Humboldt leaves for South America, he says that Goethe has given me new organs to see the world. And that is really the moment when Humboldt becomes this bridge between enlightenment and romanticism. And that's why he, I think, becomes very important for a lot of romantic thinkers later on, because he says that it is not enough just to collect empirical data. We need to use our imagination to understand nature. And he talks, for example, about the importance of landscape painting, of poetry, in order to understand nature. And those are exactly the things that then, for example, Henry David Thoreau finds so fascinating, because Thoreau is struggling between being a poet and being a scientist. And he really finds an answer to his dilemma in Humboldt's writing. And a lot of Humboldt's books are very much a blueprint to today's nature writing, because he combines poetic landscape descriptions with hard scientific data. And that, for me, makes them such amazing reads.
What's your favorite book by him?
What's my favorite book by him? That's a very difficult question, but I think it's probably Views of Nature, which he wrote in 1808, first in German, and then it was later translated in 1849. Sometimes it's translated as Aspects of Nature, but it's very much a book where he describes nature globally as this web of life, but he also describes nature so poetically. And then he has these very, very long and detailed scientific endnotes after each chapter. So what you can do as a general reader, you can just stick with his landscape descriptions. But if you are so inclined and you want to know more about the science behind it, you can then look into the footnotes. So it's this kind of perfect combination for, you know, a scientist, but also for someone who just enjoys nature writing. And for me, that book is really the mother of all nature writing.
Now, he visited America in 1804 and met President Thomas Jefferson, and they had a meeting of the minds. Why did he come to America?
So Humboldt is brought up in Prussia in the late 18th century, and he's brought up very much with the ideals of the American Revolution and then later of the French Revolution. So when he leaves South America to return to Europe in 1804, he adds a little detour because he wants to meet the President of the United States, Thomas Jefferson. And as you do, he writes a letter to Jefferson, and Jefferson is very excited to meet Humboldt, not only because this is a, you know, like-minded scientist, because, of course, Jefferson was also a polymath, but also because Jefferson has just acquired the Louisiana Territory in the previous year for the United States, and Humboldt had spent a year in Mexico. So Jefferson then bombards Humboldt with questions about their new neighbor, Mexico, and Humboldt happily unpacks his maps and his notebooks to brief the President of the United States. So that's the kind of political aspect of their visit. But also, Humboldt comes back with, in his letter to Jefferson, he writes that he comes back with kind of fossils and information about nature, and all of that interests Jefferson immensely. So they really, really like each other, and they continue to correspond until Jefferson dies. And the only subject they avoid is slavery, because Humboldt is a lifelong abolitionist, and he actually never talks to Jefferson about the subject, but he talks about it a lot with his friends while he's in Washington, D.C., and he's also he criticizes it very publicly. He writes articles in newspapers about slavery. He always questions American visitors, too, when they visit him in Paris and later in Berlin. Why has America still not dealt with slavery? He has one of his books gets translated into English, and the whole section in this book where he criticizes slavery does not get published. So he writes a letter to American newspaper saying, you know, this is not an authorized translation. The most important part of this book is not published. So that's the one subject they don't talk about, Jefferson and Humboldt.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Andrea Wolf about her terrific new book, The Invention of Nature, Alexander von Humboldt's New World. I was wondering if his holistic view of nature influenced his social values, because he was also shocked by the treatment of the indigenous peoples of America. He greatly respected their culture. So did he see a web of society like he saw a web of nature?
He very much sees humankind as being part of nature. And he says, nature is our greatest teacher. And what we can learn from nature is there aren't any inferior or superior races. Mm. So he very much sees humankind as part of nature and therefore does not see a hierarchy within race. So yes, it very much informs his ideas on justice and equality.
And he was also, you say, the first to relate colonialism to environmental destruction.
Yes, and that I think that's the interesting thing if you think about topics today. If you read whatever climate change campaigners kind of talk about, or Naomi Klein, for example, also the importance of linking economic, social aspects of society with climate change. And Humboldt does that in 1800, basically, because he says that he talks about how colonialism creates, monoculture and therefore destroys the environment. So he kind of looks at these economic aspects. He talks about all bad things in the colony are the result of imprudent activities of the Europeans. So he's incredibly critical of colonialism in terms of that it creates a system of dependency and injustice, but also that it destroys the environment.
He also had a profound effect on some modern scientists. You mention James Lovelock's Gaia hypothesis. It seems to be almost a direct adoption of Humboldt's view.
So I don't know if he has actually read Humboldt. What I'm saying is that Humboldt basically predates Lovelock's Gaia theory by 150 years. This idea that Earth is a living organism, you know, that nature's thumping with life. And interestingly, Humboldt writes this book, Cosmos, which becomes, you know, which really makes him famous across the world. But originally, he considered the title Gaia for that.
Now, Darwin was also very much influenced by him. You say that Darwin would not even have boarded the Beagle, gone on his voyage on the Beagle, without Humboldt.
Yes, so Darwin reads Humboldt's book, Personal Narrative, as a young man. And Personal Narrative is part travel account and part scientific treatise of Humboldt's exploration in Latin America. And it's that book, Darwin said, that made him want to go on the Beagle. So he said, without Humboldt, I would have never gone on the Beagle. And if we look at Darwin's Humboldt books, which, you know, just like Muir's books, are also still in existence in an archive in Cambridge. And we also see that he highlights hundreds of passages in Humboldt's books. And we can see how Humboldt influenced Darwin. So we have, for example, first of all, that he actually wants to go to South America. And when he is in South America, Darwin almost views this new world through the lens of Humboldt's writing. And he says, for example, I mean, his letters are full with comments such as, at the moment, I'm only fit to read Humboldt. It's almost like he needs Humboldt's eyes to view this kind of new world. And then he models very much his own writing on Humboldt's style, so kind of this combination of evocative landscape descriptions and scientific observations. And he also uses Humboldt's books when he's working on his evolutionary theory. So he kind of finds examples there. And there are some extraordinary examples where, because Humboldt describes how animals keep each other in check, their population. He describes how jaguars are chasing capybaras, for example, and that if they wouldn't be eaten by the jaguars, the capybaras would multiply. And all of this Darwin underlines, and there's one bit in one margin where he writes in pencil, he says, what positive check. So there are a lot of already kind of evolutionary ideas in Humboldt. He was actually called by a friend a pre-Darwinian Darwinist. So there's a lot of influence from Humboldt on Darwin.
Now, this book is very much in line with other books that you have written, books about Enlightenment scientists and thinkers of the 18th century, like the book Founding Gardeners, which we spoke to you about previously. Coming to Humboldt, do you feel like you've come to the apotheosis of these kinds of figures who were such giants when you think of the intellectual heritage of the world today?
Yes. What interests me really is because a lot of people used to ask me, like, you know, are you a garden historian? I'm like, no, not at all. I'm not even a gardener. I'm interested in the relationship between man and nature, basically. That's how I got into the, you know, looking at plant collectors, for example, or looking at imperial plant explorations, but also how the founding fathers kind of used nature in a political sense. And in a way, Humboldt is, how shall I say that? It's almost like it took me 10 years to dare to tackle Humboldt because he kind of sits above all of this, so much so that I can't come up with a new book idea at the moment because everything seems so small and boring compared to him because he's just this kind of umbrella which brings everything together. I really do think he's the most extraordinary historical figure I have ever worked on. And if, you know, if there would be just one person to invite to a dinner party, I would invite Humboldt because you could talk about everything.
Well, it's a terrific book, The Invention of Nature, Alexander von Humboldt's New World. I want to thank you so much, Andrea Wolf, for writing this book and for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you for having me again.
Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from The Invention of Nature. Next up, Jack Cushman of Insight Climate News talks about what the Climate Pact in Paris did and didn't achieve. We also talk about the omnibus budget just passed by Congress and what it means for the climate. Stick around. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. So what really happened at the climate talks in Paris? Critics like climatologist Jim Hansen called the agreement a sham. But Bill McKibben called it a step forward, albeit not enough to avoid catastrophe. And environmental groups mostly saw it as a sign of rare, real hope. Jack Cushman is one of my go-to guys when I want to know the real story behind the climate news. I spoke to him about two new articles for the website he works for, Inside Climate News. The first is about the Climate Pact. The second is about the omnibus spending bill that was both good news, bad news for the climate. Jack Cushman, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Well, I'm glad to be with you today.
You've written a number of articles since the historic climate talks in Paris in December. Let's take the first one. That's where you kind of go over what was gained and what was left out. In your article, Nations Approve Historic Climate Treaty, but Road Ahead Not Easy. So first of all, tell us, why is this a historic agreement?
Well, for the first time, we have a climate agreement that explicitly engages essentially all the nations of the world in the effort to control climate change. Previously, there have been agreements which mostly focused on the industrial countries, which have caused most of the pollution to date that is bringing about climate change, but they have largely left without any prescription countries who are just beginning the development path that, unless we change business as usual, would severely exacerbate the problem. And so this time around, before signing the treaty, the negotiators managed to get pledges from 195 or so countries, 190 countries, each explaining what they feel they're able to do at this time, and that engaged the whole world. That is really historic, because there's no way to solve this problem if only some countries in the world deal with it aggressively. Every country can't be expected to do the same thing, but every country needs to be involved. Every country is affected by climate change.
Now, there are those like James Hansen, who called it a sham. Bill McKibben said it was a step forward, but won't keep us from catastrophe. What are their problems with the bill, with what happened? What are their criticisms, and what's your take on them?
Well, I would have to let Jim Hansen speak for himself. He's one of the most renowned climate scientists and one of the earliest to call attention to the problem. I think that there's an array of perspectives on how to approach this problem, and there are many people who feel that it's necessary to be much more prescriptive and much more explicit about what everybody needs to do. At the same time, we have a United Nations, but we don't have a world government. We don't have an entity, an authority, which can impose on every nation in the world what it ought to do. So what the negotiators tried to do this time was to build a framework around which we can attempt to get to these very ambitious targets. I think that Dr. Hansen probably feels that it's going to be too difficult to get to the target using the tools which are at hand right now. I think Bill McKibben probably feels that it's a big challenge to engage the public in kind of a worldwide movement of the kind that he has been attempting to organize, but that he has a great deal of faith in the power of people to change and the ability of societies to evolve. And there has to be a great deal of evolution, and it has to happen very quickly if the world is going to achieve the ambitious targets that it's setting in Paris.
I asked Jack Cushman about the fear of some critics that no mandatory targets have been included in the climate treaty.
Well, let me just say this. There are not mandatory targets, and a mandatory target would be at some level silly. Since there's no mechanism to go around the world and tell everybody where to set their thermostat, so to speak. But there is a mandatory process here. There's a binding process that all of these nations have agreed to. And that process envisions a fairly rapid and resolute increase in ambition. It envisions a change in financial mechanisms to enable the neediest and the most vulnerable to be treated fairly and to make progress without saying to them, you have to forego development or you have to endure poverty as a way to protect the world. And these ratcheting mechanisms and the transparency of the process were very important to put into place. Now, I don't want to be Pollyannish and suggest that this Paris Treaty solves the problem. Nobody believes that, and nobody's going to be able to judge the success of this treaty until 2025 or 2030. So the people who I met and talked to in Paris, among the tens of thousands who were attending this meeting, seemed very resolute, and they talked about leaving the meeting and the very next day getting to work and recognizing that there were 5,000 or 6,000 days of hard work ahead, that it wasn't the work of 2 weeks, and that we wouldn't be judged by our words, as the French president put it, but by our acts. And so now we move into a new phase, and we'll see how fast can we go and how ambitious can we be, and whether, in fact, we have the skills and the innovative capacity to reach these ambitious targets, such as 2 degrees or even 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming by the end of this century.
If you've just joined Reuters Voice, we're talking with Jack Cushman about his articles in Inside Climate News. The first one we're talking about is his take on the historic climate talks that concluded in December in Paris. We'll be talking next about the omnibus bill and renewables and oil exports, but we'll hold off on that for just a little bit. Because one of the things you talk about in the first article, headlined, Nations Approve Historic Climate Treaty, but Road Ahead Not Easy, is that a big issue was around the 1.5 versus 2 degrees of warming. And, you know, the news from the scientists is becoming more and more alarming. The 2 degrees are way beyond the point of catastrophe. Even 1.5 is going to mean that we are going to have tremendous losses and trouble dealing with climate change. First, explain the difference between the two targets and why this is such a contentious issue.
Sure. Well, for some time, the world has been aiming at an attempt to avoid what it loosely called dangerous warming. And as the science emerged, it became clear, as we understand better and better the direct linkage between our emissions of pollution and the warming of the planet, that there was going to have to be a concerted worldwide effort to contain carbon dioxide, especially pollution, or we were going to face catastrophic warming. And we were on a course where the warming might have amounted to 4 degrees, or if we did absolutely nothing, maybe even 6 degrees Celsius of warming, and that would have meant a truly far-reaching and perhaps in some aspects unlivable changes in our climate. Now, the nations started by making their first round of pledges, and basically these were enough to bend the curve and maybe bring the anticipated warming by the end of the century down to 2.5 or 3 degrees Celsius. That's really not good enough because the anticipated effects, such as sea level rise, would have wiped out island states and many coastal communities. The effects on food systems would have been severe. The loss of the Arctic ice sheets, the acidification of the oceans and destruction of coral reefs would have been so costly that it's really a dangerous situation for humanity to accept that level of warming. So that's why we have ratcheting up mechanisms in this treaty. And the question is, how far can we ratchet? How quickly can we reduce emissions? And what kind of target should we have in mind? At one point, it was thought that 2 degrees warming was a reasonable target. And we're on course to emit the carbon dioxide that would bring that about just in the next few decades. So that in itself is an ambitious target. But there's a difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees If you live in the Marshall Islands, at 2 degrees, your country might disappear underwater. At 1.5 degrees, it might not disappear underwater. If you're looking at the coral reef ecosystems, at 2 degrees, at 1.5 degrees, you might save half of the tropical coral reef ecosystems. At 2 degrees, you probably wouldn't be able to save most of them. And these are fundamental to the ocean's food chain. For the Arctic, at 2 degrees, you would certainly see open seas in the Arctic, no ice in the Arctic in the summertime at some point after many decades. At 1.5 degrees, you might retain more of the Arctic ice. If you're interested in the glaciers of the Himalaya, which feed rivers like the Mekong River, there's a big difference between 2 degrees and 1.5 degrees. If you're interested in the food production of sub-Saharan Africa, there's a big difference between 2 degrees and 1.5 degrees. And based on the science, the nations of the world decided that they could no longer be quite so glib about 2 degrees, and that they had to at least say, let's have an ambition for 1.5 degrees, because the differences for many people are profound. Now, what does it mean that we do differently if we want to limit warming to 1.5 degrees? You know, we've already had 1 degree Celsius of warming as a global average. That's why we're experiencing, you know, in this part of the country, Christmas Eve is going to be in the 60s and 70s. So what do we have to do differently to stay within this very ambitious target? And the answer is, and it's been spelled out by the scientists in their latest reviews and was very persuasive at the conference, the answer is we need to do the same things either way, but we need to do them much faster in order to meet 1.5 degrees. And in fact, to meet 1.5 degrees, we really have to belly up to the bar and say, we're going to be paying more to meet this target. And the developed countries have to move exceptionally fast to meet this target. Otherwise, and in any event, we're likely to overshoot the target and find ourselves clawing back and trying desperately to get CO2 out of the atmosphere, which is a lot harder than putting it in. So the one thing to bear in mind is that these two courses are both kind of uncertain, and there's some overlapping. If we get really lucky, we might be able to aim for 2 degrees and hit 1.5 degrees. If we're really unlucky, we might do things that we meant to get us in at 1.5 degrees, but find us actually edging up toward 2 degrees. The two courses overlap to some extent. And so the thinking is, let's be ambitious. As the leader of the talks said, it would be much worse to aim too low and hit the target than it would be to aim too high and miss the target. In other words, we'd rather be ambitious and miss than not be ambitious and come in with a lazy track record. So nobody knows what the outcome is going to be. It largely depends on how hard you're willing to try. And then the next thing it depends on is what kind of incentives do the governments of the world decide to build in to change our behavior? Because one thing's sure, if we don't change our behavior, we're going to be at 3 degrees or 4 degrees, and that's terribly unacceptable.
And some even say 7 or 8 degrees.
It just depends how little you choose to do.
Right. Now, one thing I wonder is, why wasn't a carbon tax talked about? I mean, when we talk about a carbon tax, we're talking about something that would tax fossil fuels, but not give the money to the fossil fuel industries, but rather, you know, in I think the most popularly talked about plan would actually return a dividend to every resident of the country where the carbon tax was. Oil right now is at its lowest in a very long time. Wouldn't this be the time to have a carbon tax and to talk about it?
Well, some people say so, and many economists view the carbon tax as the most efficient way of putting a price on the pollution that we add to the atmosphere, rather than treating it as something that has no value or no cost to anybody at all. There are many ways to attach a price to our pollution: cap and trade systems, carbon pricing, carbon taxes, carbon trading. are different mechanisms. It's up to individual countries to decide how they want to do this. It is the case that, for instance, Larry Summers, a former Treasury Secretary, feels that a carbon tax, that now is the time to do it. But it is the case that carbon pricing is spreading through the world. It's not the place of these negotiations, of course, to have a worldwide tax on carbon. This is not the way the world works. We don't have a worldwide taxing authority, and taxes in different countries are handled to each according to his own devices. But many of the emissions of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere now are already covered by one form of carbon pricing scheme or another, and it is the intention of these negotiators to build mechanisms that will make more coherent the relationships and the connections between these carbon pricing mechanisms. The advantage of doing that is that once there is more or less universal pricing of carbon, then markets, investors, and pollution control authorities can search the world and find the cheapest way to control these gases and focus our resources on the low-hanging fruit, and one hopes have a much more efficient and much more effective approach to take. In this country, we have had a very hard time getting the Congress to impose carbon taxes, and this has been tried many times. But there is a consensus among economists and among many astute policymakers, including from both parties, people like George Shultz, people across the political spectrum, that rational economic decision-making requires price signals. And it's not impossible that this country will grapple with this issue and one day decide to put a price on carbon. In the meantime, you get your energy for cheap and the pollution for free.
Now let's move on, Jack Cushman, let's move on to your next article in Inside Climate News. Bill allowing oil exports gives bigger lift to renewables and the climate. Now this is referring to the omnibus spending bill, which had a whole lot of things that people both liked and didn't like in it. You zero in on the oil exports, and also renewing the tax credits on renewables. So first, let's talk about the oil exports. You ask a question. You open the article by asking a question. Who drove the harder bargain in the federal budget compromise this week? Republicans who ended the ban on exporting crude oil from the United States, or Democrats who extended tax breaks for wind and solar power? So tell us the answer to that question, and maybe set us up. Tell us what was at stake.
Sure. Well, for a long time, the United States has refused, by and large, to let the oil companies export crude oil from this country. They can refine it into gasoline and diesel and so on and export that. But except for Alaska, which is geographically a separate case, oil produced in the United States stays in the United States at least until it's refined. And the oil companies really wanted to change that. And one reason that it was particularly urgent for them now is that we are increasingly awash in oil. We're producing a lot of oil in this country these days. So with their friends in the Congress, it was becoming increasingly evident that the oil companies were going to prevail in this, and they were going to push through a bill to open up exports of crude oil from the United States. Environmentalists really don't like this because they understand that in order to keep global warming under control, most of the fossil fuel reserves that we already have need to be left in the ground, and much of the oil that we already have available to us needs to be left in the ground. Maybe not most of it, but much of it. And so they view this as antithetical to that premise. However, this was coming down the pike, and I think what happened was the Democrats said, well, what do we have that's worth trading for this concession to the oil industry? And the principal thing is the subsidies that have until recently been in place off and on for renewable energy, principally solar and wind, which get very substantial tax credits. Right now, if you put solar panels on the roof of your house, your tax credit is 30%, and to get 30% of your expenditure paid by the federal government by knocking it off your tax bill is a very significant incentive. And with those incentives in place, wind and solar costs have been coming way down, and renewable energy has been the principal source of new capacity to generate electricity in this country for the past year or two. These prices are bound to continue to come down, but Congress was about to let these tax credits lapse, and this would have been very disruptive to this industry, which is now employing a lot of people and making a great deal of progress in cleaning up our air and in keeping us on our goals for reducing carbon dioxide emissions. So along with a variety of other horses available to be traded, such as a land and water conservation fund and the ability of the U.S. to make donations to the Green Climate Fund and other hot-button climate-related or environmental-related issues, the big trade here was for oil exports on the one hand and for renewable subsidies on the other hand. When you ask yourself, was this a climate-friendly change or a climate-unfriendly change, it looks very much like, if you do the math and say how much carbon dioxide emission is going to be avoided by continuing these subsidies for renewables, as opposed to how much carbon dioxide emission is going to be allowed by increased drilling, it looks like the balance tilts very strongly in the favor of the Greens. Some people even say 10 to 1. And it's more than what the immediate balance is. These industries are just entering their adolescence, and they needed a one final boost. It was as if you were trying to decide whether to stop educating your kid in eighth grade or whether to go ahead and let them get out of high school. And once they got out of high school, you were pretty sure they were going to be on the right course. They'd get a college education, they'd get an advanced degree, they'd move on and prosper. But if you let them out of school at eighth grade, you're really missing that opportunity. And wind and solar have just graduated from eighth grade, and this bill puts them right through high school and onto the path toward adulthood.
Oh, that's terrific. Now, in fact, the impact on Wall Street seemed to be pretty immediate.
Yeah, well, Wall Street wasn't impressed by the oil export allowance as being much salvation for the oil industry right now, because oil prices are locked into a very tough pattern right at the moment. You know, oil only costs about a third what it did a year ago. And so low prices are bad if you're in the oil business. Solar and wind prices for solar panels and building windmills have been coming down very dramatically. And low prices for your product are good if you're in that business, because a lot more people will buy these products if the prices are low. And so business is booming in these areas. So Solar City, which installs panels on rooftops, went up about 25% on the day this news was announced. Exxon shares sat right on the floor where they've been. And so if you trust the market's judgment, this was a win for renewables.
Now, one analyst said that the tax credit extension will likely result in utility-scale solar contracts being signed for less than 4 cents per kilowatt hour on a regular basis over the next 2 years. Utility-scale solar contracts, tell us, what would that mean?
That means when Google wants to lock in a price for electricity to supply its massive computers that make Google run. These are big computer farms, and so they need steady, reliable sources of electricity. Google can now lock in that supply of electricity at amazingly low prices from solar farms, from firms that are out on the grid with massive arrays of solar, or with the big solar towers where the mirrors in the desert reflect the heat up into the big cauldron at the top of the pole and create steam to generate large amounts of electricity. That's utility scale solar. That's not your little rooftop panel. Mm-hmm. And when you build at that scale, you can bring prices down to 4 cents. I don't know about you, but out here in New Jersey, we pay about 10 or 11 cents per kilowatt hour. And so if solar can bring it in at 4 cents, that's a huge difference. I heard Al Gore at the conference in Paris talking about this, and he said, you know, there's a big difference between 0 degrees centigrade and 1 degree centigrade. At 0 degrees, you have ice. At 1 degree, you have water. And he said there's also a big difference between cheaper than and more expensive than. When solar and wind are cheaper than coal, who would choose coal? Mm-hmm. When coal is more expensive than solar and wind, who would choose coal? And he's saying that as the costs of providing clean electricity continue to come down, just as your cell phone costs have come down, just as your computer costs have come down, people are going to flock to these industries, and that will be a more powerful force in bringing to end the uncontrolled pollution with carbon dioxide than any number of government policies. So the government policies like tax credits that just encourage this just at the moment when the encouragement is most needed are the very important triggers for the ending of fossil fuels. And one thing that everybody understands, you know, whether it's 1.5 degrees, 2 degrees, 3 degrees, 4 degrees, in order to stabilize global temperatures at any level, eventually you have to stop putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And so what this treaty does is to say we see a future where at some point there will be zero net emissions of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And the only real question is, how fast can we get there and how much harm can we avoid by moving there more quickly?
Well, John Cushman, it's been just great to have you discuss these absolutely crucial issues for us. Your two articles appeared most recently in Inside Climate News, which you write for. Nations Approve Historic Climate Treaty, but Road Ahead Not Easy. And the second one is Bill Allowing Oil Exports Gives Bigger Lift to Renewables and the Climate. And we'll be linking to both those articles on the Writer's Voice website. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. Nice to talk to you again.
You can find a link to Jack Cushman's recent posts on the Climate Pact and on the Omnibus Spending Bill at writersvoice.net. And are you looking for some real last-minute Christmas gifts? Go to writersvoice.net for a short list of some great books to give. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.